Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro-Libertate Radio, a full-throttle, no-holds-barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gregg.
So here's how things have progressed so far. Several years ago, I don't remember how long this would have been. This would have been obviously after September 11th. How long after September 11th isn't clear. We first heard the idea that there have to be some slight modifications made in the way that the government prosecutes or interrogates and then prosecutes people who are non-citizens who were accused of terrorist acts or plotting terrorist acts or somehow involved in this large and apparently all-powerful international terror network. If you're a non-U.S. citizen, you're not somebody who was born or naturalized as a U.S. citizen, you're not protected by the full panoply of rights that are the natural and inalienable possession of American citizens. You're not us, you're them. That, of course, was one of the tenets being drummed into the minds, or what passes for the minds, of people who listen to the Republican-aligned herd poisoners in corporate talk radio. The obverse of this was the idea that if you were designated an enemy combatant, an unlawful enemy combatant, well, that's a completely different status. You're neither fish nor fowl. You're a tertium quid, a third thing. You're neither a citizen nor are you a POW. You live somewhere in this amorphous limbo land type of a status, where basically the government gets to do pretty much whatever the government wants to do to you because you don't have any protections at all, neither by the Geneva Convention standard nor by the conventional constitutional standard. The Bill of Rights doesn't apply. None of the ancient protections in the Anglo-Saxon history and tradition of liberty under law apply. And so you're basically animated meat. The government can do with that type of a person whatever it wills. But once again, this is a different type of person, we were told. They are separate from and completely foreign to the entire question of the rights enjoyed by American citizens. That's what we were told. In the same sense, we were told that enhanced interrogation, to use the English translation of the exact same phrase from the German used by the Nazis. Enhanced interrogation, torture, that sort of thing should be considered an option if you're dealing with exigent circumstances, the proverbial ticking time bomb. The idea that Jack Bauer has to use some form of exceptional duress in order to wrest from a recalcitrant terrorist critical details about the dirty bomb that has been set to go off in Chicago or New York or Cleveland or San Francisco, etc. But this should only be used, obviously, in exceptionally freighted circumstances, and it should be used with due diligence and utmost sobriety. As a matter of fact, the unspeakable Alan Dershowitz wrote a book, the key point of which was the idea that we had to institutionalize torture to the point of having torture warrants that would be issued by a judicial authority of some sort, probably not by an Article III court, a federal court, probably not by a regularly constituted body of the judicial branch, most likely some kind of presidentially created special commission that would have some kind of pseudo-judicial function. All this, of course, once again, dealt with the idea of imperative necessity. These things were all spoken of the type of circumstances that would be so outrageously rare and that would have so little connection with the daily life of American citizens that you and I, common American citizens, ordinary, run-of-the-mill people whose fortunate habit was to be born here in the United States, don't need to trouble ourselves about the prospect of finding ourselves on the receiving end of these types of exceptional measures. These are not police state measures. These are not police state impositions. This is just good, solid, hard-nosed, admittedly, bare-knuckle counterterrorism. And it all has to do with them rather than with us. And then we deal with the case of Mr. Faisal Shahzad. Kaiser Soze is how he's being referred to by some radio hosts. That's an interesting little cultural reference. And Kaiser Soze being sort of a master of misdirection, there might be some truth to that. I'm still waiting for an opportunity to catch, perhaps in reflected light out of the corner of my eye, the false flag behind this entire situation with the Times Square pseudo-bomb. It wasn't really a bomb. It was more like an elaborate pile of junk. But here's a guy who, for better or for worse, apparently for worse, for much worse, is a U.S. citizen. And yet, once again, the first thing that we're being told is that because of the crime of which he stands accused, he should not have the benefit of Fifth Amendment immunities. Specifically, that whole suite of due process protections that are referred to commonly as Miranda rights. The entire Republican-aligned, Cheneyized, punitive populist, quasi- or proto-fascist conservative talk radio and media community today has been resounding with what they call debate over whether or not to recognize this U.S. citizen's rights against self-incrimination. The Wall Street Journal put out the talking points this morning. Here's the relevant excerpt. One regrettable part of this investigation so far is Shahzad's arraignment in a Manhattan courtroom yesterday on terrorism charges. This means he has been allowed to lawyer up and told of his right to remain silent rather than being subjected to more thorough interrogation as an enemy combatant. Once again, if we could, and I'm sure that with a little bit of spelunking in the caverns of hanatized or ditto-head rhetoric, I could find the relevant sound bites. You could almost certainly find representative samples, many of them. It wouldn't be like panning for gold. It would be more like going out and gathering manna in a basket, except manna is valuable and this is not. You can find plentiful examples where, up until very recently, the idea was that an enemy combatant is somebody who is not a U.S. citizen. He's somebody who is not protected by the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the presumption here that the government has to make a case to treat him in a certain fashion, which means that they have to make a case before a neutral judge that he is a danger to the community. Of course, that means habeas corpus, immunities apply to the person being accused of this act, that he has, of course, the right to legal counsel and all these other things. What they're saying is by virtue of him being suspected of terrorism, he is ipso facto an enemy combatant. An enemy combatant has no right against self-incrimination. That being the case, as Professor Bainbridge, who is a blogger who examines legal issues, in the headline of his essay on the subject asks, why not just torture the SOB? Which, of course, is exactly what the Cheneyized Republicans and the Cheneyized talking heads would like to do. As far as they're concerned, once again, by virtue of being accused of this crime, you are, by virtue of that accusation, a terrorist. You're not a criminal suspect. You're not accused of committing terrorism. You are a terrorist because the government has designated you a terrorist. Government, of course, for this purpose, apparently, being oracular and infallible. The same government, of course, that cannot be trusted to run the healthcare system, which, of course, it cannot, because it hasn't the competence. The same government that should not be permitted to own and manage and operate lands throughout the Western United States, which it shouldn't. It doesn't have the constitutional mandate. It should be kept within its constitutional cage if we're going to trouble ourselves to maintain a federal government of some sort. And that, of course, is a very open question as far as I'm concerned. But for the purposes of imprisoning and brutalizing or summarily dispatching somebody with extreme prejudice, the government apparently is all competent. It really is a bizarre contradiction. I think it's a form of derangement, quite frankly, that you find among certain types of conservatives. As far as they're concerned, the only thing that government should be permitted to do without cavil or question, without qualification or limitation on its powers, is destroy property, kill human beings, and torture those it doesn't bother to kill. And, of course, that's the business end of government. The business end of government, of course, is the ultima ratio regis, the last argument of the tyrant, which is the canon. It's the cutting edge of government. Excuse me. Whether you're talking about the headman's axe or the guillotine blade. You see, that's the essence of contemporary conservatism, is that the entire society, the entirety of society, all society rests ultimately on the executioner. That it is the executioner who is the foundation of society and that which holds together everything that we cherish. I'll talk a little bit more about this on the other side of the break. This is Will Grigg. I'm back after a protracted hiatus. Maybe I'll share some of the circumstances that led to that involuntary vacation on the other side of the break. This is Pro Libertate Radio. 866-986-6397 is our call number. 866-986-6397. I'm back with you again live on the Liberty News Radio Network, and we'll be back in just a minute. So stick around.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
1-866-986-6397 is our call number. 1-866-986-6397 on the Liberty News Radio Network. I am Will Grigg. I am back after an unexpected and unwelcome hiatus. Part of it, as a matter of fact, the largest part of it was occasioned by a really nasty strep infection that left me on Saturday morning with a temperature of almost 106 degrees, and I spent most of Friday, that is to say from about 3 in the afternoon until 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock Saturday morning, radiating a body temperature that could have been used, I suppose, to cook eggs. And that meant that I didn't get any sleep, and I spent the next several days recovering, and I'm still recovering from it. It was a really nasty infection, and of course that meant I had to take antibiotics. I don't like antibiotics, and my experience last August with C. diff has left me very aversive to antibiotics. They tend to put your intestinal flora out of balance, and when that happens, C. diff is one of the possible consequences. I had never heard of C. diff until I contracted it, and it quite nearly killed me. And so I've been on tenterhooks the last couple of days dealing with antibiotics and probiotics and then anti-probiotics. You see, you take probiotics, you end up sometimes with thrush. Boy, it's interesting, this little domino effect that occurs whenever you intervene with pharmaceuticals to deal with one of life's little maladies. And thrush is a condition that leaves a person with very painful, anybody who's had a child with thrush will appreciate this. Babies sometimes get it, and I understand why they're cranky. When you experience it yourself, it's no fun at all. Your entire mouth becomes sore. It's not merely a sore throat, it's a sore mouth. Sort of the point where you can't eat, sort of the point where you have a great deal of difficulty speaking, and that was where I was Tuesday night and last night. So, I'm back, and I'm happy to be with you again, even though the circumstances, once again, in which we find our beloved country are rather grim. And this is because not only are we dealing with the problem of terrorism and problems such as illegal immigration and the effect that that has on life, liberty, and property, but also the action that is the reaction to these problems. And somebody, I don't know who it was exactly, decades ago, coined the expression, the action is in the reaction. And often, if you're dealing particularly with terrorism, there is an objective, a strategic objective on the part of terrorists when they conduct terrorist attacks or failed terrorist attacks. Merely the threat of doing something that would entail damage, chaos, mayhem, and destruction can have a catalytic effect in a favorable direction in terms of the policy preferences of revolutionary terrorists. I referred a few programs ago to Carlos Maragueia, the Brazilian Marxist theorist of urban insurrectionary warfare and terrorism, who talked about the idea that one of the objectives of terrorism is to provoke an authoritarian reaction from government for the purpose of consolidating power that, of course, will then end up in the hands of revolutionary types, and also discrediting the existing political system. Now, it's not that difficult to discredit political systems, because political systems almost universally in human experience have been based on force and fraud. They've been based on plunder. They've been based on the repression of people for the benefit of others. And so it's pretty easy to discredit that type of a system. And terrorists, of course, want to discredit such systems, but only on a contingent basis. They want to discredit those systems when they are in the hands of people of a political and social perspective they don't care for. And that, of course, brings us back to Lenin, as most such discussions do. Lenin's maxim was the grand key to revolutionary politics in the 20th century, and it remains relevant today. His foundational maxim was that all politics ultimately devolves into the question of kato gavo, who, whom, who does what to whom. That which is done to us is unconscionable, but when it is done by us, then it is entirely acceptable. And the Republican Party is in the hands of Leninists. Oh yeah, you can say a great deal about the cultural Marxist bona fides of the current occupant of the White House. He is a cultural Marxist. However you package him, however he is presented to the public, irrespective of the sanctimonious twaddle in which he has swaddled, he is a cultural Marxist. He talks about community organizing as the praxis of revolutionary change for the purpose of bringing about redistribution, or redistributive justice, I believe, was the way he described what a community organizer seeks in that properly notorious but nowhere near sufficiently widely known interview from 2001. So yes, Barry Sotero slash Barack Obama is a cultural Marxist, but he is different from the leading lights of the Republican Party only in terms of his preferred constellation of constituencies. The Republican Party really isn't so interested in redistributing wealth to the masses. It's more interested in redistributing wealth to the military industrial, homeland security, detention, torture, and subversion complex. That's pretty much what they're all about. Dick Cheney is, for all intents and purposes, the love child of Vladimir Lenin and Joseph de Maistre. I think I mentioned Maistre before. He was an 18th century French Catholic conservative who, as a youth, found himself fascinated by and drawn into the seamy underworld of covert revolutionary politics, organized around fraternal societies such as, you know, Freemasons, that kind of thing. He dabbled in it, and then he became an arch-reactionary. He really is, if you will, sort of the 18th century equivalent of a neoconservative. The neoconservatives, most of them, at one point or another, had been involved in the Trotskyite strain of hardcore revolutionary Marxism. Well, Jacobinical organization and activism in the 18th century was the equivalent, or actually the ancestor, of Marxist revolutionary politics of the 19th and 20th century. And Mr. de Maistre, according to a profile that was written of him by Isaiah Berlin that I read about 20 years ago in Isaiah Berlin's book, The Crooked Timber of Humanity, he was somebody who dabbled in this demimonde of Jacobinical politics. And then he emerged from that, particularly after seeing the consummation of that type of activism in the French Revolution, he emerged from that really as the hardest of hardcore reactionary conservatives. There are some people who say that Maistre was sort of an antecedent of the really hardline, flint-faced, right-wing totalitarian movements, the nationalist movements of the late 19th century that tended to be tributaries into fascism, phalangism, national socialism, things of that sort. I don't know. That's something I'm going to have to study in greater detail. But this is what he has to say in his essay called The Executioner about how society is organized. Quote, "All greatness, all power, all social order depends on the executioner. He is the terror of human society and tie that holds it together. Take away this incontrovertible force from the world, and at that very moment, order is superseded by chaos, thrones fall, society disappears." Now, my conservative pinup of that era was Edmund Burke, who was also terrified by the French Revolution. He had a completely different take, however, on how society should be organized. He wrote in his Vindication of Natural Society, To prove that these sort of policed societies are a violation offered to nature, it needs only to look upon the sanguinary measures and instruments of violence which are everywhere used to support them. Let us take a review of the dungeons, whips, chains, racks, gibbets, with which every society is abundantly stored, by which hundreds of victims are annually offered up to support a dozen or two in pride and madness, and millions in abject servitude and dependence. There was a time when I looked with reverential awe on these mysteries of policy, but age, experience, and philosophy have rent the veil, and I view this without any enthusiastic admiration. Burke understood that the instruments of state repression represent a net subtraction from society. Maestro believed that the executioner was the foundation of society. Call me a Burkean in that respect. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397. We'll be back in just a minute.
Memory Press.
So why do I spend so much time rummaging around in the esoterica of 18th century conservative literature? Well, it's because there are a couple of contending strains in conservatism, and the dominant one right now is that represented, if you will, by Joseph de Maistre, rather than that represented by Edmund Burke. Edmund Burke was somebody who was very, 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 very leery about the exercise of power for the purpose of protecting society. That is, political power. He was very critical of the government of Great Britain. When he was a parliamentarian in Great Britain, he was very critical of the British Ministry for the Americas in terms of the way it treated the American colonists. He gave a wonderful speech during the very early phase of the American War for Independence in which he expressed, as many people in Great Britain did at the time, many people in London in particular were very fond of their alienated and refractory American cousins. It was called a plea for reconciliation with the colonies, and the point he was making in that speech was that the actions of the government in London in terms of trying to repress American independence, in shunting aside the grievances expressed by the colonists, those actions imperiled the rights of Englishmen everywhere. And then a couple of years later, he wrote his letter to the sheriffs of Bristol, in which he talked about the evils of suspending the writ of habeas corpus as it applied to Americans who were considered to be unlawful enemy combatants against the crown. Now, Joseph de Maistre, on the other hand, was somebody who believed, basically, that anything that derogated from the majesty of the absolute ruler was a threat to society. He believed that society had to be held together through force and terror. Edmund Burke understood that society is organic, that society is built through consent, through contract, and through convention, through tradition. And those are things that really are threatened by the implements of what he called the policed society that, as a very young man, he came to abhor. Robert from Colorado is with us. Good evening, Robert. How are you doing?
Maybe a little better than you, huh?
I'm doing better now than I was doing yesterday, and far better than I was doing on Saturday.
Welcome back
to
the airwaves.
Day of service? I'm sorry?
Welcome back to the airwaves.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
I have multiple subjects I want to broach with you, none of which will include the state law in Arizona.
Okay.
let's start light and then go heavy. Did you happen to, maybe you didn't since you were a little ill, but did you happen to catch any of the correspondence dinner in the nation's capital last weekend?
Well, I saw that Jay Leno bombed and that Obama made a joke about murdering the Jonas Brothers with a Predator drone strike.
Yeah.
And I wrote about the latter, but not about the former.
Yeah, I never knew he had such a talent for stand-up. Let me share with you some of his other pearls. I believe he started out by saying, tonight's humor brought to you by Goldman Sachs. They will make money whether you think this is funny or not. My ratings are down, but at least they're still running high in my birthplace, Kenya.
Yeah.
And then the highlight was, well, the Republicans will tell you that there is a hidden section in the new health law. Totally ridiculous. In point of fact, there's over 100.
bucket of fish. Anyhow, make sure to tip your waitress. Yeah, I feel a lot of love in this room. Now, the thing that I noticed about his routine, and this is true of most presidential routines, but this year's edition was more pronounced in this respect than previous ones, is that he's trying to extract humor from situations in which he is really the source of other people's problems. You see, humor doesn't work if it's the bully who's making light of what he's doing to you. That's not ribbing. That's mockery. That's the sort of thing that you find on the playground when the bully knocks you down and gets your pants dirty and makes fun of you for having dirty pants. Yeah. On the other hand, if somebody on the receiving end makes light of what's happening, that becomes funny. I mean, if, for instance, somebody from Pakistan whose neighborhood had been wiped out by a Hellfire missile fired by a Predator drone had made a comic remark about it, that would be funny. It would be tragically funny, but it would be funny. It's not really that much fun if you're dealing with somebody who's actually got blood on his hands. You know, probably 600 or so innocent people have been killed by Predator drone strikes since February of 2009. Yeah, that's not really a fertile ground if you're looking to harvest humor, I think. But the thing about his stand-up routine is that it was written by the staff scribes of The Daily Show. And that, I think, pretty much closes the books on Jon Stewart, rather, as an actual critic of the regime. When you're actually collaborating ad majorem gloria, dear leader, you can't be considered a critic. You can't be considered an independent pundit or commentator. I mean, that level of collaboration is something that really speaks ill of that entire enterprise. And I used to like that show, and I still think that Jon Stewart is a talented guy. It's just he's sold his soul in a buyer's market, I'm afraid.
Yeah. The so-called terrorist bomber in Times Square, I say so-called because for a smart guy, he sure made a dumb bomb. But it was on May 1, which is euphemistically known as May Day. I always thought that was what pilots said when their starboard engine is blown and they're about to crash, but apparently that's not what that means at all. What is the origin of May Day?
May Day, if I'm not mistaken, is Beltane. Beltane is I'm trying to figure what would be the antonym of holiday. It's not a high holy day. It's the demonic or occultic reverse or counterfeit or photographic negative of a holiday. I think Walpurgis Nacht, if you read Faust, the first part of Faust by Goethe, there's a whole section where basically the doctor seeking this illicit knowledge from the devil, from Mephisto, is involved in making that transaction on Walpurgis Nacht, and that's the night before Beltane. Beltane being in ancient pagan circles a day that's replete with fertility rites and all kinds of celebrations of the uninhibited carnal impulse. And it was adopted as an international day of solidarity for revolutionary figures back in the 19th century. And, of course, it's the most notoriously known as the day that a fellow who is a professor of canon law in Ingolstadt University by the name of Adam Weishaupt created the Bavarian Illuminati back in 1776. And that's the sort of subject that really isn't discussed very often as if it were a matter of aberrant fiction, but it's not. You can go and look at Rousseau and Revolution by Will and Ariel Durant. There's a whole section talking about the importance of Weishaupt and the Illuminati. There's another discussion of the same subject in The Age of Voltaire. There's even elements of it in The Age of Napoleon. There are three books in that history of civilization that talk about Weishaupt and the Illuminati. And then James H. Billington's book, Fire in the Minds of Men, The Origins of the Revolutionary Faith, has a whole section talking about the importance of that tradition, that occultic tradition in modern revolutionary politics. Billington's the Librarian of Congress. I don't think he's a right-wing kook. But traditionally, May Day had been looked upon as a very important, almost a day of obligation for the international labor movement and radicals attached thereto. It was also considered a very important holiday for the National Socialists. That was a day that they referred to, I believe, as Law Day. But they were really a strand of the same revolutionary movement. They were sort of a distant and largely disavowed cousin, but they were kindred to the same revolutionaries that you saw take over in Soviet Russia and elsewhere.
Communists.
Yeah, communists, exactly.
Mm. Gotcha.
Yeah, Mayday's a bad situation all around in terms of its origins and purposes. And it's become very much in vogue over the last couple of years. Mayday has achieved a new salience. And that's something that I think attests to the resilient perversity of the revolutionary ideal. The ideal of, you know, of course, seizing power in the name of the oppressed and then adding further might and power and maleficent influence to the state that you're supposedly trying to tear down. You know, they don't want to abolish the state. They want to take it over and abolish us.
Gotcha. With the movie Victus and other things, there's been a lot of talk about Mandela. And the more I hear about that guy, what little reading I've done on him, I think the less I like him. I hear he's pretty much a socialist, got rid of prayer in South Africa back in the 70s. I hear he killed quite a few people, too, just people he didn't like, just round them up and killed them. The necktie deal, all that mess. What do you know about Mandela?
Well, that was his wife. I think his the first of three wives that he's had, Winnie Mandela. Robert, you want to hold through the break?
Yeah, I do. I want to finish this up.
Okay, Robert will be back with this after the break, but he's asking about Nelson Mandela, Winnie Mandela by derivation in the movie Invictus and the myths that have been woven around that figure and some of the things that happened in South African history. We'll talk about all those things and much more on the other side of the break. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network, 866-986 is 1-866-986-6397 is our call-in number. We'll be right back.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
We're talking with Robert from Colorado about Nelson Mandela, this recent movie Invictus, which I'd like to see because it's about rugby, a sport I quite like. I dabbled in a little bit as a younger and even more foolish man than I am right now. And it's part of the rolling real-time hagiography, I think, of Mr. Mandela, who's perhaps the only figure more universally revered in the left-wing pantheon than the incumbent president, Barack Obama. And you were asking about Mr. Mandela's connection to some of the horrible, grotesque acts of terrorism that were carried out by the African National Congress during the 1980s. And for the most part, when you're talking about necklacing, which is an incredibly barbarous way of killing somebody who was considered an informer by cutting off his hands and then usually binding him with barbed wire and then draping a tire around his neck, soaking it in gasoline and setting the tire on fire. And of course, the tire would be burned. The rubber would eat into the flesh of the victim, which would be like brimstone. It would literally embed itself into the flesh and prolong the agony of death. And there are video records of that type of grotesque murder by torture that can be found if you want to look for them. I'm not really going to direct people as to where they could find them because I don't want to be responsible for what people will see. And this was something that was being promoted as well by Jean Aristide down in Haiti. He was something of a distant disciple of Winnie Mandela, but it was Winnie Mandela really with their so-called football club. It was basically a gathering of street rabble who would go around, stomp people, beat people, intimidate political enemies of the ANC. She was the one who was really promoting this. I don't know how much direct involvement Mandela had in this. She had gone into the business of political terrorism and economic thuggery while Mandela was still in under house arrest. And very quickly, I mean, by that, within a couple of years of getting out of prison in 1990, I think Mandela was alienated enough with her that they separated and they divorced shortly thereafter. I don't think that he was ever a Marxist radical of that order of magnitude. And as I've read his speeches in his trial from the early 60s, I find myself sympathizing with his grievances and somewhat sympathizing with the idea that at some point, if you've got a government that is dispossessing you, which was going on with the black South Africans at the time, you cannot simply surrender the right to armed self-defense. But this isn't what we're talking about when you're talking about necklacing and acts of wholesale slaughter and dispossession of your political opponents. You're talking about doing the same things that the government does, perhaps more directly and more crudely. But Mandela himself, I think, is unquestionably, from my perspective, a socialist. I don't think he's ever disavowed that. There are pictures of him standing next to Joe Slovo of the South African Communist Party in moments of ritual solidarity with a clenched fist salute as the hammer and sickle flag is flying in the background. So he's definitely somebody who's very comfortable in that milieu. If he were an actual freedom fighter, he wouldn't be. I don't know to what extent he was a doctrinaire Marxist. He's not as bad as many of the people who have held power in that unfortunate continent. As a matter of fact, I was of the opinion that once he was elected president, it was almost a certainty when he was released he was going to be elected president, that he would be in the longest, or in the tradition, rather, of the big man theory of African politics. You'd have one man, one vote once, and he'd be president for life, just like what's going on in Zimbabwe. But he wasn't that type of a ruler. And South Africa has not gone to hell quite as quickly or quite as comprehensively as I was afraid it would. You know, thank God for small favors in that department. But I do resent the fact that there's this effort to beatify Mandela. It's not something that is all that relevant to our present concerns, I think, but it's just interesting that they keep coming back to this particular well. They keep finding these figures to lionize and deify, who are by any rational reckoning, revolutionary socialists who really didn't do anything to improve the lot of human beings in terms of their rights, their life, liberty, and property.
But bottom line, he is a bad guy, though, correct?
Yeah, I mean, the way it shakes out, he is a bad guy. He's not he's not in any way, shape, or form somebody I'd consider a hero.
No,
I do think that. I do think that he had the distinction of fighting a bad government. You can say the bad government is a that's a tautology. There is no such thing as anything other than a bad government. But I don't think that I would consider him to be, even with all his flaws, even with all the flaws of this particular figure, and the figure I'm thinking of is Martin Luther King. For all of Martin Luther King's flaws, and they were substantial, and they have been completely buried by politically correct historiographers. I wouldn't say that Mandela was a figure as admirable as Martin Luther King was in terms of Martin Luther King's analysis of what was going on and his desires with respect to, for instance, foreign policy and things like that. And once again, Martin Luther King's a mixed bag. I didn't like his redistributionist economics. And he was, once again, somebody who found himself comfortable in the association of revolutionary figures of the sort that no decent person would want to have in his home. But I think that, yeah, in the grand scale of things, I'd consider him a bad guy, Mr. Mandela.
Yeah, one last question, and I'll jump off. You, one day last week, you were talking about Clinton and all the things he was involved in, Kosovo and on, but
yeah.
Wasn't he involved with the machete killings in Rwanda in the mid-90s? Wouldn't he?
Well, what he said is that the United States should have intervened, and he did this during his grand, not self-abasement, but national abasement tour in 2000 when Air Force One was effectively rechristened. Sorry about that, and he made a tour of Africa and Asia, basically apologizing for the faults and failings of others while exempting himself from the necessity of making amends for what he'd done wrong. He can't apologize for somebody else. That's just a basic principle of ethics, as if ethics and Bill Clinton have anything to do with each other. But
no.
What happened to Rwanda is that another Nobel laureate, Kofi Annan, who at the time was the head of the UN Peacekeeping Division, had prior knowledge of the planned genocide, and he had been given detailed information by Lieutenant Romeo Dallaire, the Canadian military official in charge of the peacekeepers. I've interviewed Mr. Dallaire, and I think he's a pretty decent guy. He still believes in the UN system, but boy, is he disillusioned about how it works, and with good reason, because he had learned about what was going on. They were taking specific census information, the census, and they were locating, the Hutu government of Rwanda was locating all the Tutsi, and they were going to wipe them out. And he told Kofi Annan about this in late December, early January, late December 94, early January 95, Annan told him to give that intelligence to the government that was planning the massacre, and then forbade Dallaire to do anything to interdict the massacre. He was going to go out and they were scooping up all the firearms from the civilians, but they weren't permitted to disarm the government death squads that went out and hacked people to death by the hundreds of thousands. And the people with machetes were backed up by people with automatic weapons.
The UN peacekeeping.
Well, no, the UN peacekeepers didn't back up the people. The UN peacekeepers just sat there in their barracks and watched.
When they weren't raping women.
Exactly.
And who was the attacker, the Hutu? What'd you call them again?
Hutu. H-U-T-U. They're built like me. They're sort of shorter and darker and thicker through the shoulders and neck. The Tutsi are tall and willowy and more elegant. They look a little bit more like the Ethiopians, the Tutsi do. They were favored by the Belgians when Belgium was running the place as a colonial protectorate back in the 19th century. Mm. And that set in train all kinds of ethnic resentments that coalesced into bouts of mutual bloodletting that would alternate. One would kill the other, then the roles would be reversed, and then by 1995, the Hutu were in power, and they were going to wipe out all the Tutsi, and they wiped out over a million of them. Well, a million Tutsi and Hutus who weren't collaborating.
Yeah.
And it was just an ugly, ugly thing. But that's the work, the collaborative work, if you will, of the Nobel Peace Prize winner in 2000, Kofi Annan.
Yeah, you know, there you go. Okay, thanks, bud. Take care.
Take care. God bless. Good to hear from you. Very quickly, there's an item here on ABC News saying that Mr. Shahzad, Faisal Shahzad, had contact with our old friend, the American-born radical Muslim cleric Anwar al-Awlaki, who was the subject of a U.S. death warrant. Gosh, that's awfully convenient. You've got this guy who's a U.S. citizen who apparently, according to this report, and this is all based on anonymous sources, which means that it has no practical news value except as an indicator of where the government is going to be going with this. Basically, what they're doing is they're trying to lay a predicate for a more aggressive war in Pakistan. That's where this is headed, Pakistan and Yemen both. And that war is going to be waged by way of those instruments of death from which Mr. Obama and his scriptwriters sought to extort comedy. They're going to be using the Predator drones armed with Hellfire missiles in acts of targeted assassination in Pakistan, Yemen, and elsewhere. And, of course, that's going to result in more blowback. We're going to have more incidents of terrorism, both of the false flag variety and probably the genuine article. And both of those types of terrorist incidents serve the regime's purpose as well, because with every terrorist incident, they consolidate their power that much more. It's good to be with you. I'll be back tomorrow night. I may have some important news tomorrow night, so tune in for that. And join me online at freedomintertime.blogspot.com for Pro Libertate, the blog. Be aware that there is a place to donate if you have the means and the inclination. I'd sure appreciate that. I'll be back with you in 23. And until then, as always, doom spirit of Pugno. While I breathe, I fight. Good night, good luck, and God bless.